Part 3. Davin. Chapter 12. The Embrace of Bone. Sanguinius felt the shadow before Geron Mortis reported the contact. His shoulders tensed, his wings straightened, preparatory to a flight of combat. The presence of the shadow pressed on his spirit. He raised his eyes to the shuttered bridge windows as if he could see through them and perceive the enemy beyond. The angel sensed the shadow was much nearer. Its presence seemed heavy enough to crush the hull of the Red Tear. When Mortis called out, Sanguinius asked, "How close?" Space was a lie, yet battles could still be fought on the foundation of this illusion. Mortis worked the controls of the Auspex array, lips tight with frustration. "I can't get a consistent reading." On the screens, the readings of the vague mass of the shadow kept changing. The Phantom raced ahead of the fleets, then it was stalking them from behind, then keeping pace on different flanks. The vox channels between the bridges of the three flagships were now open continuously. "Brothers," Sanguinius said, "are you detecting an intruder?"
"We are," Gilliman said.
"Is this the same contact you had before?"
"It appears to be."
"The readings are nonsense," said the Lion. "It is now between my formations and yours, Sanguinius."
The changes in the shadow's position were rapid. At the same time, there was a sinuous flow to them. Instead of blinking in and out of existence in its impossible locations, the spectre moved like a river, like a current, like a serpent. Sanguinius began to see it less as a presence, more as a manifestation of malaise, encircling and weaving its way through the fleets, spreading its influence by the fact of its presence alone.
"You fought this," Gilliman said.
"To no effect, though we lost some ships."
"Combat is futile," said the Lion. "There is no target. This must be a phantasm of the Immaterium."
"Do you think so?" Sanguinius asked. He took a breath. It grated with the effort. A huge stone weighed down his chest.
"Are you telling me you can't feel its presence?"
"Perhaps," Gilliman said after a pause.
"That is nothing we can fight."
The Lion's evasion betrayed his unease. His brother's uncertainty disturbed Sanguinius. It was possible for them to view the Phantom as a mirage. He could not.
"Do not dismiss it," he said.
Before he could continue, the shadow appeared directly before the Red Tear. Elongated, made of night, it dwarfed the battleship. It fired a single shot. The defensive scans of the Red Tear recognized the attack, but not its nature. It appeared on the screens as a line, direct as lascannon fire, but it was dark, a lightning strike of black hitting the battleship. The Geller field flickered. The failure's duration was less than a microsecond, but the shot came through. It pierced the shielding. It slashed onto the bridge. A thin beam, black as despair, precise, unerring. It struck Sanguinius in the chest. The shadow passed over the night haunter in his cell. He caught his breath. His eyes widened, staring into nothing, and in that nothing he felt dread. He had foreseen the shadow's arrival, but now that it was here, the future turned into a cascade of doubt. Possibilities multiplied, then winked out. The certainty of the implacable succession of moments vanished. They were replaced with a blank. Nothing. Kurz frowned. He shook his head, the only movement he could make, trying to clear the amorphous, mocking fog that billowed through his thoughts. Anticipation, the bleak, remorseless companion of his consciousness, fell silent. He fell into limbo. The future left him. He gasped. His body convulsed with psychic pain. He had foreseen the arrival of ignorance only in the last few seconds before it descended on him. He had thought he was mistaken. He had not believed in the loss of the fundamental principle of his life, of the nightmare bedrock of his existence. Yet it had come, and he did not know what came next.
"You are a barrier," he whispered to the shadow. "You conceal, but you change nothing. There is nothing that can be changed."
The tremor of a memory ran through him. He saw himself again on the crag, the angel transformed with rage, descending upon him to kill with his bare hands. He had lost the thread of the future in those seconds. The stream of futures had stuttered, paused. The moment of his death, the absolute that defined all others, had begun to slip from his grasp. For those terrible seconds, fate had seemed mutable. He had been confronted with the horror of a universe that not even fatalism could explain. But then the lion had materialized in the chamber. He had stopped the execution. Kurz had fastened his grip on the future again, and the moments to come had begun hammering through his skull once more. It was the closest thing he had known to relief in decades. Now, though, the future was blank. He strained against his manacles, as if he could physically force himself through the barrier and see once more.
"Nothing changes," he said. "Nothing changes. Nothing changes."
Beyond the barrier to his vision, the future unfolded as fate had determined it would. That was the lesson he had learned from his arrested execution. He had been wrong to doubt then. He would not doubt now. The shadow blinded him, but that was all, and it would pass.
"Nothing changes," he said.
But the fog lingered. The seconds passed one after another, whose form he did not know before they came. And he did not know when the fog would lift. Without foreknowledge, he could not act. The blindness was worse than his physical shackles.
"Nothing changes,"
he shouted in defiance. The blankness remained. It was a barrier, he told himself again and again. It was not a slate waiting for fresh script.
"Nothing changes! Nothing changes!"
The scream echoed back and forth along the prison corridor. It fell into the background noise of the deep hum of the ship's engines. Kurz shrieked his defiance again. The barrier remained. On the other side, the future resided, hidden from its darkest prophet. M'Kani Kano was nearest to the angel when the psychic beam struck him. Sanguinius staggered, stumbling off the command dais to the main platform of the flying bridge. He doubled over, clutching his chest. Kano rushed to his side. Ascalon and the duty squad of the Sanguinary Guard were a few steps behind. Kano put his hand on the angel's shoulder.
"My lord!"
Sanguinius reared upright with a sudden jerk, his wings spread wide, pinions shaking with anger. His eyes glistened black. He turned to Kano, his face a perfect marble carving of rage. For an instant, he was indeed a statue, the nobility of his bearing transformed into the aspect of a predator. Then his lips drew back over his fangs. Hatred consumed his features. The air around him crackled. Kano smelled burnt ozone. On instinct, he raised a defensive psychic shield. Sanguinius lunged, but Kano was too slow. None of the angel's sons would have been fast enough. Sanguinius seized him by the gorget and lifted him high. The angel's jaw opened and closed as if straining to speak. The tendons of his neck stood out, taut as iron cables about to snap. No words emerged from his throat. The fury was too great. Snarling and groaning at once, Sanguinius threw the librarian down. Kano slammed through the nearest cogitator stations to the dais, crushing a servitor and sliding 15 feet across the deck. Sanguinius pursued. He leapt over the wreckage of the cogitators and landed before Kano. He took the librarian by the chest plate and hauled him up. Kano's training warred with his loyalty. He could not strike his Primarch. He tried to pull away, but Sanguinius lifted him above the deck and drew the blade en carmine. Ascalon grabbed the angel's arm. Sanguinius lashed back, hurling Ascalon away. His eyes never left Kano.
"My lord!"
the librarian pleaded, trying to break through the haze of fury. The black orbs stared through him, unblinking. Another hand arrested the blade. It was the Herald's. Kano did not know when Sanguinius's proxy had arrived. He had not been on the bridge a few moments ago. The angel yanked his arm free, dropped Kano, and turned, snarling, on the Herald. He froze. Primarch and Herald faced each other motionless. Psychic energy burned around the edges of the angel's wings. The Herald said nothing. Sanguinius held the blade high, but it did not descend. Kano saw the Primarch's face reflected in the mask of the Herald, snarling fury mirrored in unchanging serenity. The angel froze at the sight, and then the black dissolved from Sanguinius's eyes. His breathing slowed, no longer gasps of rage. He lowered the sword. He blinked, looked around, and after a moment of incomprehension, his face contorted with understanding and grief. He went to Kano's side.
"Are you injured?"
he asked.
"I am well, my lord,"
Kano said.
"Do you know what happened?"
Sanguinius paused before answering.
"Not entirely, no. Enough to be on my guard."
"Was it the thirst?"
Kano asked. The symptoms had been different, though the overall effect of insane violence was similar.
"No, this was different."
Sanguinius returned to the command dais. He looked out at the bridge, at all the witnesses of his madness, both blood angels and mortal. The unaugmented officers were pale. They had seen worse on Cygnus Prime, but the reminder of the madness on that world was disturbing to mortals and blood angels alike. On the Auspex picked screens, the position of the phantom continued to fluctuate. It seemed to be pulling away now.
"By injuring one, I have done you all an injury," Sanguinius said.
The savagery Kano had faced was gone. All the nobility of the angel had returned, austere in its acknowledgement of pain.
"But the attack by the enemy failed. It was repulsed."
He nodded to the herald.
"The foe that has destroyed our ships has suffered its first defeat."
He paused.
"I am not invulnerable. None of us are. We have faced this truth, and with that knowledge, we are more determined and stronger. Despair and hubris are the paths to defeat, and we will not be defeated."
Since Cygnus Prime, and during the period of Imperium Secundus, every word Kano had heard Sanguinius speak had been tinged with melancholy. The burden of his tragedies was a heavy one. Kano found it difficult to hold at bay dark thoughts about the Legion's destiny. How much harder, then, for the Primarch? He had to contemplate the reality that tainted blood was his gift to his sons. Since the victory on Pirin, though, Kano thought he had detected a change. Now he was sure. Sanguinius's eyes were still marked with care, their gaze fixed, it seemed, on a distant point, eternally considering how the present moment and a future end aligned. What was different was his voice. He sounded as if he had encountered something he had considered impossible, and he had been renewed. The weight of concerns had not lifted, but new possibilities had opened before him, and he was eager for the challenge. Though the angel, too, was disturbed by what had just happened, the attack had run up against a core of hope that was stronger than before. Kano wished he felt more reassured than he did. Sanguinius looked at the silent crew and legionaries. His face was shadowed with concern again.
"I will be in the Sanctorum,"
he said to Kano, and withdrew from the bridge. The angel was still in meditative mood several hours later, when the fleet translated back to the Materium.
"I have the coordinates," said Mortus. "This is Davin."
At last, Kano thought. He felt a sharp stab of premonition as the shutters parted. Silence descended on the bridge again, as the system came into view. The blood angels gazed upon an immensity of death. A grey sphere surrounded the Davin system. At first, from the point of translation, it had appeared almost featureless, except for a porous quality that made the lion think of dilapidated stone. Its gravitational well was weak, barely pulling at the fleet. "Why do I feel like I'm looking at a grave?" Holguin asked.
"Not a grave," the lion said, as the fleets moved closer and the details of the sphere resolved in the oculus. "An ossuary."
He shook his head in disbelief.
"This thing is made of bones."
The Invincible Reason came within 1,000 miles of the surface of the necrosphere. Auspex scans zeroed in on small areas and projected magnified hololiths on the tacticarium screens. Individual bones and complete skeletons interlaced, creating a cracked, knobby plane. There were bodies of humans, Eldar, orcs, of every Xenos race the lion had ever encountered, and an even greater number he did not know. Abyssal solemnity radiated from the necrosphere. It was perfect stillness, the quiet of the end of everything. Beyond it, the frenzy of the ruin storm was more intense, and the bones appeared to float in a sea of agonized colors. The materium bled around Davin, and the system was death lurking at the center of the wound. The lion ordered an exploratory bombardment. The invincible reason, the honored deeds, and the intolerant fired Nova cannons. It was like shooting through fog. The beams cut through the necrosphere. Vast clouds of debris rose into the void, and a chasm opened, wide enough for the combined fleets and stretching for tens of thousands of miles. "What does this barrier mean?" Holguin wondered.
"At this moment," the lion said, "it signifies only its own weakness. Death falls before us. We will not be stopped."
The lion took the Dark Angels into the necrosphere. The other fleets followed, descending into the endless grey. The physical passage through the necrosphere was easy. The mental one was less so. Gilliman, Prato, and Gorod marked the journey in Gilliman's chambers. They stood before a floor-to-ceiling window. As the Samothrace journeyed through the shell, the nature of the necrosphere became clearer. Grey remains, broken from their moorings by the blast, floated past the vessels. The boneyard of the infinite contained more than the skeletons of beings that had once been alive. There were the skeletons of dead vessels, of cities, and of worlds. The inanimate had turned to bone. Iron and stone, alloy and gas, everything was bone and cold and grey. Planets had rib cages now, and cities had skulls, the better to show that they had died. Other corpses were harder to identify. Some had the shapes of colossal beings, human and Xenos. Others had crystalline forms. Still others were spheres themselves, smooth as the back of skulls.
"Are those statues?" Gorod asked.
"They are still bones," Gilliman said. "They are something that has died." Prato grunted in psychic pain.
"Hopes," he said. "Dreams. Philosophies."
"The forces we have been combating favour symbolism in their attacks," Gilliman said. Prato was speaking from a more visceral knowledge, but Gilliman could see the possible meaning in the corpses Gorod had pointed out. If statues represented abstractions, the skeletons were the demises of those ideas. It was as if, in their death, they had been given flesh to rot away, and bones to mark not the promises that their existence had made, but its futility.
"Contact!"
Lortenex's voice buzzed from a wall-mounted voxcaster. Then, a moment later,
"Correction, I was mistaken."
"Mistaken in what?" Gilliman asked. "What sort of contact?"
"I thought there was movement, Lord Primarch," said Lortenex.
"There is nothing in the scans. Perhaps it was more floating wreckage."
Wreckage, not remains. Lortenex was using distancing language. All the bridge officers were. They were keeping the reality of the necrosphere at bay. Gilliman understood. That was their luxury as mortals. If they turned away from the reality, just enough to blunt its meaning, yet not so much as to create a misleading picture of what they were confronting, he would not correct them. He did not have the same flexibility. His lot was to look at the real directly. He must face all truths in all their horror, or he risked basing crucial theoreticals on a lie. He worried that he had already done so. The sin of Imperium Secundus was a heavy weight he could not set down. He had not found atonement yet on this crusade. Instead, he had found this embodiment of absolute death. Gorod drew his attention back to the window.
"Look at that,"
he said, pointing to one of the dead dreams. It had a human head. A halo of spiked bones radiated from its crown.
"What was that, I wonder?" he said.
"What it was no longer matters," Gilliman answered. "It is the ones that are not present that matter. They still live." He believed what he said, though he felt staggered by what he was seeing. The necrosphere was the final extension of the theoretical transformed into the practical. The ossuary took his guiding principles and turned them into a mausoleum. "The dream of the Imperium is not here," he said. "It is not dead." He wondered, despite himself, if he might see Imperium Secundus entombed here. "This is the death of all dreams." The voice was authoritative, proselytizing. It did not feel like his. It felt like the whisper he had heard in the fight against the word-bearers. "Past and present and to come, all the hopes are here. Their murder has happened. The promises are over. This is their silence, the end of words."
"Lord Primarch,"
Althusa broke in on the vox,
"Lortenix has seen the intruder again. I have as well. The Auspex readings are too fragmentary to be of use, but that may be due to the material of the sphere limiting the reach of the scans. The sighting is definite. We are being shadowed."
Gilliman looked out into the grey tunnel down which the fleet was travelling. There was a flare in the distance as the Lion's vessels fired again, punching deeper into the shell. He could see as much as a few miles into the sides of the tunnel. The bones were loosely clumped together. The fabric of the necrosphere broke apart easily. It revealed nothing but more skeletal remains, the grey stillness extending forever until lost in the shadows.
"Where is it?" said Gorod. "Well, there must be other passages through the shell," Gilliman said. "Sanguinius's warp phantom is in the Materium too now."
"If that is a single ship," Prato said, "it travels with suspicious ease. The Blood Angels have been encountering it since they left Macrag."
Gilliman stared at him. Prato's choice of words made pieces of the dark mosaic fall into place.
"It travels," he repeated. "A pilgrim."
"You think it might be the cause of the constructs we've encountered?" Prato asked. "If so, can it be fought?"
"Maybe not the cause," Gilliman said, thinking over the tales Sanguinius had described hearing in the refugee camp. "Perhaps a catalyst. The witnesses said its arrival marked the beginning of ruin. It brought change with it. They saw that. None of the survivors of Piran mentioned the fortress. That happened after they fled, after the pilgrim had passed."
"I like that theory better than Titus's," Gorod said.
"So do I," said Prato. "We still don't know what it is or how to fight it."
"Or even if it's here," Gilliman thought.
Only the Blood Angels had had any true contact with it. It was a ghost, cruising through warp and minds. Its being was indefinite. It hovered between myth and threat. The pilgrim was uncertainty itself, neither real nor illusion, lurking just beyond the horizon of the observable. From there it spread doubt. Gilliman wondered if it had already targeted him. He pushed the question aside. It was another trap of uncertainty. He would not construct theoreticals on an absence, a shadow, a phantom. The bridge became an assembly of sentinels. The word went out across the fleets to watch for the pilgrim. The scans were continuous. The guns of three legions pointed at the depths of the surrounding tunnel walls. The hours passed. Gilliman stood at the pulpit, staring into the grey sepulchre. The stillness went on and on and on. There was nothing but the bones of life and hope and reason. The universe beyond ceased to exist. The temptation arrived, insidious as it was insistent, to believe that there never would be anything except the grave. The fleets had willingly entered the trap. There would never be anything to fight. The legions would journey through the infinite grey until they too became still, became bone. Quiet crept onto the bridge. The hum of the engines, the whine of servitor joints, and the clatter of keys at data stations became a fading background. The voices of the mortal crew members, as they queried and answered each other, fell below murmurs. The quiet was grey. It was dust falling, burying light, burying hope. Gilliman watched the bones. He did not waver. If this was the last thing he witnessed, then he would stand guard until death. The grey did not go on forever. It was, in the end, what it had appeared to be, a shell. It was a few million miles thick, a hair's breadth in comparison to its diameter. The fleets emerged into the encircled void of the Davin system. For the first time since it had begun to rage, the ruin storm was invisible, hidden behind the necrosphere. "We are in the eye of the storm," Gilliman thought. The calm here was a lie. Ahead, centred in the oculus, glinting in the grey darkness, was Davin. The shine of its reflected light was the cold of the most profound death.